to the printed page, life holds its meanings and its secrets differently. The reading lamp helps, and the quiet room, because they help us to focus our thoughts. But mostly it's our willingness to follow the author's eye into a particular look at life that really moves us. I'm Susan McGinnis. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with writer and teacher Renee Manfredi. Her first book, a book of short stories, is called Where Love Leaves Us. Renee, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to ask you first about setting. The stories in Where Love Leaves Us are set in Pittsburgh, in immigrant neighborhoods, Italian and Irish and Catholic, that also seem to be being pulled into a new kind of American diversity and stressed by that. Is this the Pittsburgh where you grew up? Is this your family life that you're telling us about?
Yeah, I didn't grow up in the ethnic neighborhood, but the geography and the psychology of that is still in place in my family. It's very ethnic and very patriarchal still.
Mm-hmm. The people in your book seem to emerge very logically, very naturally out of that place. I grew up in California with a Scottish American background, and I thought as I was reading that if these characters had come out of my background, they'd be real different people. Probably a lot of the same meanings and secrets generically that mm-hmm. I was thinking about, but real different. Are these people who are there as well, that your sense of people who kind of grow out of that background?
The people in the place, I think, are linked for me. I can't imagine them anywhere else. Mm. They're part of the land. They're linked to the land, the landscape.
Do you have a sense of which comes first for you? Is it a character that comes to your imagination, or is it the place?
When I begin writing?
Yeah.
It always begins with character for me, and the character and the place eventually intersect and become one. And finally, I can't tell the difference. The character and the place and the setting and the atmosphere are all one, finally.
And is that because it's logical for her or him to be in this room, to walk down that set of stairs? Can't be any place else?
Well, I don't think of it in terms of logic. It's just, I guess it's the internal logic of the story and the logic of that character, that particular character in that particular place.
Mm-hmm. When you walk into a room, are you real visual? I guess that's what I'm wondering. Everything feels real visual in the book. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing or hearing, or how are you approaching?
I think my imagination is primarily visual, and then it branches out into other senses, but it begins with the eye mm-hmm. and what I can see. Mm-hmm. I don't always trust what I hear. I think language is slippery and suspicious.
And the face, is that slippery and suspicious, or is that telling?
What do you mean?
Well, I was thinking about what you hear, so I kind of mentally threw us into a conversational group, again, mentally watching and listening, and I was wondering if when you're watching someone talk, watching dialogue in your mind, if the face is telling the truth, where the honesty is coming out for you.
I think it comes out visually. I think the truth is more visual to me than hearing it, mm-hmm. hearing dialogue.
Interesting. Renee Manfredi, our guest on this edition of Conversations. That first book that I mentioned, Where Love Leaves Us, is a collection of short stories, many of which are award-winning, many of which were published in other venues before they were collected in this book. It's a book that won the Iowa School of Letters Award for Short Fiction and was published as a result of that award from the Iowa School, from Iowa University, University of Iowa, mm-hmm. right? Renee Manfredi with us on this edition of Conversations. When you take us to the people in these stories, they feel to me to be people who are alive. This is not always true with stories on the printed page, but I can feel how the people in your stories have come to their feelings. Are they as real for you when you are writing these characters? Do you feel them in the room with you?
I do. Yeah. They become very real to me.
What is that like? What is that experience for you?
Well, sometimes it's wonderful, and other times it's schizophrenic, and you feel a little crazy, mm-hmm. Depending on the character.
Because part of you is him or her?
Well, I suppose since it's in my head, it's in part autobiographical in that way, but sometimes I don't know where they come from. I think one story in the book, I know where one character comes from, and he was based on my grandfather, but the rest of them I don't know, mm-hmm. but they become as real to me as people.
Is this the projectionist?
Yeah.
Niccolo?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this character. He lives in two worlds, in two times, and at some point is unable to live in the present because his other world is so strong. Can you introduce us to him? The title of this story is The Projectionist, and it's the first story in this book.
Well, certain facts of that story are based on my grandfather's life. He was a projectionist at the Rialto Theater in Pittsburgh, and my mother and her sisters went with him to work sometimes, and he used to toast his lunch on the hot end of the projector, yeah. And didn't know very much. He didn't speak English very well, and but he learned American culture from film and from the Bible. That's mm-hmm. where he learned to speak English, from the King James Bible and American film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are the events of Niccolo's life events that happened to him?
No, I made that up.
Uh-huh. And very briefly, when Niccolo was a very young man in Italy as a result of the German occupation, his wife and child, his first wife and a child in utero are killed by the Germans, and he can't leave it behind. It comes with him. I know from both something you've told me and from reading your stories that one of the things you do with writing is explore the issues of life, loss and love. And what kind of an exploration was this one with Niccolo? What's your sense of what this exploration was?
What I was trying to get at, you mean?
Yeah.
I suppose how you can live with what you have in light of what you've lost, maybe. I don't really know. I don't remember. That was a long time ago that I wrote that.
Uh-huh. When was that story written? How long were you working on this book?
Several years, mm-hmm. Over the course of my graduate career, 3 years, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe longer.
Renee spent her graduate career at Indiana University, taking a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from that school. Her bachelor's with honors in English comes from the University of Pittsburgh, the town where she was raised. While she was working on her master's, she was also working at the Indiana Review, a literary magazine at the university as fiction editor and then the associate editor, finally as the editor between, in the late 80s, between 1987 and 1991. You were the associate editor for Story magazine in 1991-92. Where's that located?
In Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio.
In Cincinnati, uh-huh. And you were teaching there then, yes?
Right.
Renee Manfredi, our guest on this edition of Conversations. You do a nice thing with, well, let me reflect something to you. One of your students said that the thing she liked best about your work was that how much respect you have for the people, mm-hmm. and that your gentle handling of the people in your stories really shows through. And I must say it certainly does in my reading too. Kind of with that, you have a story called Keeping the Beat, which in which you give us three women, all related, mother, daughter, mother, and grandmother. And they have a wonderful sexuality I have never seen in three women in the same family before. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know where that came from. It's such a gift. To most of us kind of walk around with this American notion that sexuality occurs between the ages of X and Y and mm-hmm. ends somewhere in the 30s, right? I mean, it's this peculiar thing, and neither your parents nor your grandparents ever had sex. Mm-hmm. And so there's this wonderful thing that happens in Keeping the Beat that's this open sexuality. And I wanted to ask you about how that happened, where that came from for you.
Where the story came from, or the idea of, I didn't sit down to write a story about, you know, generational sexuality. It just,
I know.
It's a story that I heard. This is one of the stories that didn't begin visually. It began as something overheard mm-hmm. in my head. Just the first line of the story started the story, and
three hot babes looking for a date or something of the sort.
Looking for love.
Looking for love, yeah. Yeah, the grandmother says this, which is really nice. All three of them, with these three women across the generations, are standing admiring themselves in the mirror before mm-hmm. their boys come, their dates come. Yeah, this is this is also a story about death's encroachment on life and on transitions, on failures and changes, and there's a lot going on in that story for you. I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is when you as a writer set to work, are you setting to work with large feelings, large topics in mind, or do these things emerge out of this place, Pittsburgh, or this older woman or this younger woman talking together?
It always emerges from character. I always have the character, and the characters usually come complete with histories and backgrounds and dreams and traumas. They just come to me that way. And I don't sit down and write and think I'm going to write about certain themes or issues. It begins with character. I see the character. I hear the character, I follow the character home and listen and overhear.
It's there full blown, and you're channeling, following?
Oh, I don't know that I mean, I'm channeling.
That's a strange word, but yeah. You open yourself to it and it comes?
Mm-hmm. I just always see the character first.
Mm-hmm. When do you know what a story is about and whatever that's going to mean?
I usually don't know until I'm done, and I try not to think about it. I think about it in terms of whether or not it's working on a technical level, whether or not I like the story, whether or not I feel it's a good story. And I usually don't feel that it's a good story. I usually don't know if it's a good story or not, mm-hmm. or a good novel.
Ever?
No, it happened once.
Yeah.
In that book.
Which one? Which one?
Bocce.
Yeah, I would have guessed Bocce. Isn't that interesting? Tell me about when you say you're working on a, you're conscious on a technical level. Is this working? Is that working? When you're looking through those eyes, what are you asking yourself? Is it word by word, sentence by sentence, or are they more? Is this visual enough, or is this? What are you chewing for yourself here?
I try not to think about it when I'm working. I feel it, and I feel it through the character. And for me, that's when I know that I'm working well, is when I feel the character in situations, in setting, in extreme emotional situations or in everyday life. I feel it. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it until it's all done. If I think too much, then it's a bust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can understand that. Do you feel me there? Do you feel the reader there? Do you wonder whether I'm getting it as you're writing?
No.
No. I'm out of the picture until the book's out of your hands.
Or usually, story. Every now and then, the critic comes into the, you know, into my study and comments as I'm working. But when I'm working well, I try not to think about audience or critics.
Yeah. The critic, is that a frowning persona?
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
There's never anyone who comes in and celebrates and says, whoa, good line.
No, huh. Never.
Interesting. Yeah, somebody talked to me once about having a gathering who would come in and I can't remember who this was, but they would say things, they said things like, and these were people who really liked the story, so they were mm-hmm. like an audience that came into the room and hung around the computer to watch mm-hmm. the screen. That would be either lucky or schizophrenic, I mm-hmm. don't know which. Yeah. Renee Manfredi is with us on this edition of Conversations. I want to ask you if you can, and I know this is hard, but if you can go back to Bocce Forest, I want to ask you about that story. This is the story about the rape, the sexual transgression of a very little girl. I felt so distinctly that the narrator doesn't feel to me to be the little girl. It feels like an adult narrator, but I felt so distinctly the presence of this child in the narration. I saw the child's point of view all the way through the story. Was that, I want to ask you how you brought Elena to us, how she got there from your mind.
Well, that was the only story. I wrote the story in 4 hours.
Wow.
And it was the only story that, I was actually working on another story when that one came. And for whatever reason, that morning I couldn't work on the story I had been working on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And that story just started, and I wrote it start to finish in about 3-4 hours, mm-hmm. and I didn't change anything. And I think it's the only way I could have written that story.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it's the only story that happened that way.
Yeah, it certainly is in a, it's a big detailed piece. I can understand how it would come in a rush. The other thing about it is that it's very stream of consciousness. Does that make sense as a description for you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, especially when Elena is in her deepest struggling time, we're right inside there with her, which actually brings me to a question about memories. I felt that one of the things you did for me as a reader in that story was to create, to show how Ellen's adult memory of that incident and of her childhood was created. Does that make sense to you as a reflection on that story?
It does. I think I was doing things with narrative in there. I was playing with the idea of time and how certain things, certain events in our lives are outside of the chronology of time in a way, and memory is a fluid, elastic thing. And I think I wanted the narrative to reflect that, that it can be in the past, but it's still overarching in a way into the present and into the future.
Right. There are graphic images that feel like they're fractured out of the Elena's present and moved whole into her soul, where she will have to cope with them later. Yeah. Did you have any sense of Elena as the adult looking back at any point? I mean, 4 hours is a short period of time. I'm pretty concentrated, but have you had a sense of that?
Since or during the story? When I wrote the story?
Yeah.
I think at the end I did. I didn't want it to end on such a grim, bleak note. And the story could have gone on, I suppose, and talked about her 20 years later. But I think I wanted to see where she would go and what she would feel years from now and the consequence and effect of something like this.
Do you have any sense of where she went? Where she could go with that?
No. Yeah. I don't.
Lots of options. Tell me about your notion of the limits of love. Now, that's a really big question, but kind of grasp onto whatever part of it works for you. The reason I ask this for people who haven't read this book or this story is that Elena is a 10-year-old girl whose father is a big cushion. He is protective and gentle and absolutely accepting and loving of his interesting and complicated and troublesome child. But he can't protect her. She can't even reach him from the place she gets to after this man invades her in a place where she should be very safe. And I wondered as I was reading this story about what you thought about the limits of love to protect us in our lives.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I think in that story, it didn't protect her, and I think the safety aspect of love is an illusion. And I think one of the characters in the book says that she thought if she found someone who loved her, she wouldn't be a hunk of ice spinning through space. And that's kind of the way I see a lot of those characters. They're trying to reach for some kind of fixity and safety, and they don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Maybe the limits are when you stop trying and stop looking.
Does this relate to that? There's a character, Provy, in
Keeping the Beat.
Thank you. In Keeping the Beat, she can't play the violin anymore.
Mm-hmm.
She's stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about, let me see if I can get back to this, about how once you learn technique, and then all the practicing after that is trying to get to that place that'll open you up and make you vulnerable. This is the less certain place, the non-fixed place, that her grandmother also knows about when she dances, right? Mm. Yeah. So this is the more solid place of love in your mind? Is that letting go, willingness to trust place?
Well, that's the hard place, I think.
Yeah.
That's the place where you're open.
Yeah.
That's, I think what that character says, is it's a willingness to stay open. Well, and the, vulnerable.
And the next line is something about some guy with a dirty tennis shoe, right?
Yeah.
Who steps on you. So it's there is willingness to be open, and then it may not be the expectation, but the understanding that it's not going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking about the stories in a book of short stories called Where Love Leaves Us, a book by our guest today, Renee Manfredi. Renee teaches at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's an assistant professor of creative writing here at UAF. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. Your characters bring to us a lot of specifics. The violin player has a whole life that is wrapped around her music and alienated from it, troubled but deeply connected with life and music. There's a deaf man who is totally absorbed by his silence. A woman struggling to become a doctor. All these people have very complex lives, and yet they allow us to see things that we feel, whether we are hearing people silent, violinists, doctors, divorced, grieving, or not. I'm curious about the way you approach grand issues through particulars. Is it because only through the particulars do the grand issues emerge? And if that's so, then how come that's so?
I think that's true for me, that the more specific the characters, the bigger the issues that come through.
Mm-hmm.
Someone once accused me of having wacky, quirky characters, and there's something wrong with all of them, and that these people are people you wouldn't want for your neighbors, and maybe that's true, but I think the bigger things emerge from the smallest details.
Do you see the people around you as quirky outside your books?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody's quirky.
So this is not necessarily people you wouldn't want for your neighbors, but these are your neighbors.
Well, not literally. No, they're not literally my neighbors, but I think everybody is atypical in certain ways, and quirky in certain ways, and ordinary in most ways, perhaps. But I think I'm interested in how people deviate from what is normal or typical, or what they're thinking underneath all the surface gloss and niceness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We look good, but we're deeper than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Conversations on KUAC. You can find the book Where Love Leaves Us, which I really do recommend. As a University of Iowa book, 1994 publication. As I said, the Iowa School awarded her its Iowa Short Fiction Award. It's kind of hard to say, I don't know why, in 1993, and then published this book for her in 1994. A lot of these stories appeared earlier in the nation's major reviews, the Georgia Review, the Iowa Review, the Mississippi Review, along with many others. You'll find her works in the Prairie Schooner, the Black Warrior Review, even the Alaska Quarterly Review, Michigan Quarterly, and a number of others. Renee Manfredi is the recipient of a number of grants, fellowships and awards. She's been working on a novel for the past couple of years under a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Conversations. We're talking to Renee Manfredi about her book, Where Love Leaves Us. Thanks again for joining us on this edition. Rita Dove said something about memory in an interview with Bill Moyers, and it's kind of stayed with me. She said, memory is how we felt at the time the thing happened. It doesn't have a lot to do with facts. I sense from your characters that this is the way they and you maybe view the world as well.
From the vantage point of memory?
Yeah.
Well, I think as a thing is happening, you don't know the meaning and the consequence and the effect of it on you or your life. And I think that's true that it emerges later. And you don't really know what it is until it's in the past. Maybe that's a gift, I think.
Reflection is the gift.
I think so.
Yeah. And part of that is because if we knew the enormity or maybe the mundanity of the event, that we wouldn't be able to be in it.
Well, I don't know about that. I think as something is happening, it's everything is pretty much equally weighted, and only later in retrospect does the balance shift and what's heavier and what's lighter and what comes to the foreground is the terrain of memory, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the reason I asked you about that again was like Niccolo in The Projectionist. He can't separate it out. It all of a sudden overwhelms, and he's inside both the memory and the present. He's sleeping and awake. Mm-hmm. In Bocce, you're creating memories that are huge in the moment and will have different weights in the future. Yeah. Makes sense. What was your family like? Part of the reason is that you create these characters who are living very much in their families, just all of them. Elena does, the projectionist Nicola does. Clearly, Graham and Grace and Pravi all do. They're all in families. They're also these highly defined, complex people. And it made me wonder where you come from.
Well, my family is very working class. Not educated, certainly not literary. There were no books in my home growing up. They're just ordinary people, good people.
Mm-hmm. But complex?
No. I think they're the most unselfconscious people I know.
Is there a difference between self-conscious and complex?
No.
No.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a difference, but they're not complex, and they're very direct and very literal. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say about them.
Well, no, I was just wondering about, because your characters are pretty complicated people, so it was just a bad assumption. No, I don't think it was a bad assumption, actually.
No. No, my family is very, very uncomplex. Mm-hmm. They're not simple. Nobody is simple, but They're not troubled at all. They're very down to earth, salt of the earth, mm-hmm. hardworking, moral people.
Mm-hmm. Did you always know you were going to write?
I always wrote. I didn't always know that I would. It was always kind of a secret, you know. I would write in secret. For a while, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. But I didn't know that it would become this for me, a kind of way to be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Always wrote. How old were you when you remember?
8. I started to work on a novel at 8.
Did you finish it?
Well, it was 20 pages, and I thought it was just very long.
Yeah, I bet, for 8. Mm-hmm. That is long. Yeah. Do you remember anything about it?
Well, it was about a campfire girl who became a spy for the government.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Some Nancy Drew or in there?
I don't remember. I think there's some Nancy Drew influences on that, maybe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Little girl with a secret life, too, mm-hmm. though. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And did you just keep writing after that and ever show it to anybody?
No. There was a break between childhood writing and adult writing when I was in college and I was studying to be something else. Mm-hmm. And I was miserable thinking I wanted to be something else. And finally, I just settled for who I was and who I had been
How did you figure that out? Did you just...
I took a creative writing class in college and came back to that. And that's what I knew I wanted to do. Uh-huh.
Sorry, just a moment. Not to worry. I want to, if you'll kind of come back with me to talk about technical things for a bit. In this group of stories, you've written from first person as a teenager, from third person as in Bocce again as an older person, but with a real sensitivity to what it must be like to be 10 years old. You've written in the present. You've written in the past tense. Did I say both first and third person? I think so. Are these in some ways for you as the writer exercises? Or when you began a story, or when you begin a story, is it just so completely logical that I tell this story now from the first person or whatever?
Well, there's a time when it was a conscious choice. I was trying not to write in first person. I thought I had too many stories in first person. I was trying to write in third person. And I was trying to write something other than a father-daughter story in first person. And it didn't work. And I just decided I needed to follow my instincts, and if I needed to write 20 stories in first person, then that's what I needed to do. Uh-huh. And then third person gradually came back. So I've learned not to force it at all. If it's in third person, it's in third. And if it's in first, then that's where it has to be.
There it is. Is first person kind of first choice because you find yourself so much inside a character?
It depends on the character, and it depends on the voice. But I like first person in general. I like to write in first person. Mm-hmm.
Any idea why?
I think it's a more complete identification with a character and his or her voice, and through, it's more personal, more intimate.
That makes sense. This is something that doesn't always happen in stories, in a writer's ability to present a world. Usually we know the protagonist, the major character's point of view real well, and we have clues to how that person feels that other people may be feeling. With your characters, we usually find somewhere along the story that there are definitely other points of view operating, and they come through the presence and the behavior and the dialogue and attitudes of these other characters. Are there more than one? This is again a family question. Is there a family of characters operating around an issue like grief or aging, or does that make sense as a question?
How do you mean? Is the whole family involved in?
Here's an example. In in the mathematics of pendulums, we can see, so people will know, there are two major characters and then three others. The two are children, a teenager and a 6 or 7 year old boy. And they're both grieving the death of their father. We see their grief real clearly. Her grief in the way she's reacting and dealing with the world. She's kind of the major, this is a first person story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's the kind of the major flailer, and we see what she's doing as grief. And then Jimmy's grief comes out in his propensity to eat dirt and his kind of weird confusion as a kid. But by the end of the story, we know that the mother's also grieving. And it's really, really clear by what she chooses to do with the Christmas tree and decorating it.
Oh.
And that's what I'm asking about, is these are separate planets orbiting. And they each have their personality. Mars is different from Earth, which is different from. So what I'm asking about is the creation of those separate griefs for you, and your choice to make the population that complex.
Yeah, it's not really a conscious choice. It just happened that way in those stories. And it happened, I think, in the novel I'm working on. I don't know. I guess you get tired of the planet you're on and you go and look for grief on other ones in the solar system, maybe.
Huh.
It's or maybe it's that, you know, grief is always looking outward. I think people in pain or grieving or in some emotional distress, I think, reach out. Reach forward instead of drawing in the way they do in calmer times. And maybe that's why grief looks for grief in that story.
Uh-huh. That's very nicely put, because you can see that. Sorry, there was something else I wanted to ask you about that, and it slipped away. It was too nice a comment, I think. I wonder if that one will come back. There are a number of different griefs in this book. Did you know that at the time, as you're writing these stories, that you're writing around different universes of grief?
I didn't know it at the time. I knew it later when I looked at the book as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Was that about you? About grief in your life or grief on the planet? How specific or general are the things you write about? I know some writers write about themselves all the time in different aspects, personalities, guises, and that's just kind of a comfortable way to work mm-hmm. lives onto the planet. And others say, well, this is never about me. It's always about the planet.
I suppose it's about me in an indirect way. I don't think any writer can write about the planet and not and claim not to write about himself or herself. Mm-hmm. I think it's always about the self, and I think when the conditions are, I think good stories begin with the self and reflect outward. And not necessarily the other way around.
Mm-hmm. When you're working with students, do you try and work them towards that point as well? Into them, whatever is in themselves or from themselves in the story?
I think I try to. I hope I am doing that.
That's a learning direction.
Well, I think what I want them to do is to listen to their own voices and to trust and to, you know, live by their own lights, so to speak. And I think only they know what it is they want to do, and I try to find that out too and to help them become more themselves and not derivations of anyone else.
Right, that I want to be a Hemingway dream needs to be killed as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. You said when we were talking on the phone today that the novel is a novel about love and it's from a man's point of view. Mm-hmm. We were looking at point of view a couple of minutes ago. What the heck, let's see if we can write this from a man's point of view?
Or was it a man
who walked in?
No, I tried not to write it from his point of view. I tried every point of view but his point of view because I wasn't. It's one thing to write from a male point of view in a story, but in a novel, you know, there are things you have to do in a novel that you don't necessarily have to do in a story. You know,
like?
Well, like go on a date. You know, and I thought, well, I don't know if I'm comfortable writing a whole novel from first person male point of view. But then it became, you know, second nature, and it felt very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. But you had to get into your guy, or let him get into you?
Yeah, so to speak.
Yeah.
I tried to write it from her point of view, the woman's point of view, and she was too unreliable and too slippery. And
which means to you what?
That she never stayed in focus. Her point of view wavered in and out. And I couldn't hear her voice after a while from her own perspective, from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And I tried it in third person from her point of view, and that seemed wrong too. This was the only choice that I found was left.
These feel like clothes to me, or that you try this on and the fit's all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
but this is about people. So it was, not only was he the best fit, if we can use a shirt or a pair of pants for it, but mm-hmm. It was his voice that was the strongest. This is my story, so tell it like I would tell it.
Well, I didn't like this character so much at first. I liked the woman much better.
Uh-huh.
But after a while, he toned down a little. He wasn't so... I just wasn't used to writing from that point of view and that from that about that kind of character.
Can you introduce us a little bit? Who's this guy?
He is working class, not educated, but smart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else to say about him.
Do you like him?
Yeah, I do.
What's he about? What's he learning or failing to learn or running up against? Or how do we, when we enter his life, what's happening to him and what's he doing? What's he happening?
Oh, he's leaving. People are leaving in this novel. And I thought it was a novel about people leaving. But I think, as I said to you this morning, it's really about, I think what obsesses me in this book is why and how people stay. And it seems like the natural thing to do, to leave. It seems that everybody is leaving, and that's the ordinary thing to do and what most people do. But I think finally what I wanted to do in this book was to explore why someone stays. And it's about learning to stay in one place, I think.
Is it staying in a relationship or in something else?
Oh, well, that, but also literally staying in one place, not moving around from place to place and from landscape to landscape, emotional and geographical and otherwise.
One of your teachers at Indiana, Scott Russell Sanders, who visited us while he was in Fairbanks, writes about staying in place. Were there any connections going back there? He seems to examine that topic.
Oh, I hadn't
breathing.
Thought about that.
Huh. Oh. Yeah, it certainly connected when you said it for me. And does he stay? Does he learn to? Does your character learn to be in one place? When we're done
well,
with him?
I don't want to say.
You don't want to say. Okay. We'll have to wait to see the first novel by Rene Manfredi will take us the first novel by Rene Manfredi will examine and we'll find out. Another psychic break. Hold on. Oh, boo, it was something you said about this book and I wanted to ask you about it. God, life is so weird. Do your characters ever do things you don't want them to do?
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, always. They're always doing things that surprise me.
And then do you just have to follow around? You have to go with them? Or do you ever just rip it out of the typewriter and say, I'm sorry, we're not doing that? It's not
well,
about
I think I try to respect the integrity of the character. And I let them do whatever they want to do. It's kind of like a class of unruly five-year-olds with the Econo-sized finger painting tools and kits. And it gets out of control sometimes, better to be out of control than too much in control, I think. You can always take things out, but you can't really put them in once the story's over. It's either there or it's not there.
And the story is a character in itself. Once the story is over, it's not mm-hmm. something you bring to closure. It comes to closure. These are active.
What do you mean? On its own?
Yeah.
Well, I think what I try to do is I believe in characters who are wild at heart, you know, and I like them wild and unfettered. And I think if you can exist within that uncertainty, then they do things that surprise you and, that, for me at least, make a better story than if I try to control what they're doing and move them around like chess pieces.
And if they have integrity, then the story is inspired with integrity and it will come to closure of its own natural act.
I think so. I have trouble with endings. I have trouble ending stories, so I'm probably not the best person to ask about how things come to closure.
But but from another point of view, it does what it's supposed to do. I mean, if we leave closure off of mm-hmm. this, the story will fulfill its purpose or discuss its questions or be a living entity on the page.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, for instance, my novel, I thought I had the ending to my novel from the beginning. I thought I knew the end. And for 2 years, I thought I had the end. And when I got to the end of the novel, on some hot August day in the middle of the Midwestern summer, I was 2 paragraphs from the end of the book, and the ending was not the ending I thought it was. And I knew maybe half a page before the end that wasn't the ending at all. And it was kind of like the book knew that, but I didn't know that. And, well, that was the ending. So that's the ending as it is now.
Huh. And were there just a couple of paragraphs left and you just had to get used to it?
A couple of pages, maybe.
A couple of pages.
It was very close to the end.
That's a short amount of time for you to adjust,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
How many drafts of this?
About a million. A lot. It feels like a lot. 3, maybe?
Of a how many page book?
500.
Wow.
That's long.
3 times around. Is that not uncommon in your stories, short stories, as well as this novel that you write until you get it right, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. I'm a firm believer in revision.
Mm-hmm. And you'll just write it over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, right, this is it.
Yeah. I write it until I get it right.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes that takes me a long time.
Would you ever be a doctor now?
I think I could be one.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I don't know. There's something about fiction writing that seems a little like surgery to me sometimes, especially in the revision process.
Uh-huh.
In the creative draft, when it's a first draft and it's new and it's hot, then it seems more like art. But going back and revising it until, you know, ad infinitum, that seems like mm-hmm. Microsurgery to me.
Yeah.
And I like to think of it in that way, you know, that you just keep operating until the thing no longer limps. And when you fix the limp, then you have this club foot and spina bifida kind of thing. You know, there's a big hole in the backbone of the book that you have to fix. But I don't think I would be a very good doctor. I mean, quite honestly.
Especially if the leg was fine going in, right? But tell me about that. You have a do you play the violin?
No. No.
You create a really good violinist.
I just made that up, yeah.
And do you cook really well?
I used to be a better cook than I am now.
But you take pleasure in creating characters who can bring us whole new worlds. We have a gourmet cook, and I was very interested in that menu for that evening. It sounded just lovely. And and we do see a violinist who talks to us about minor chords and in a way that is aural. We can hear it. Do you go out and research that? Do you go out
no,
and find out?
I don't research anything. I just make it up.
You just made it up. Huh. Do you ever have a doctor coming back to you and saying those words don't make sense in that context?
No one has said that to me yet. But maybe it'll happen. I don't know.
Yeah. Tell me what happens after this book. Any idea? Is there another character, another book, another something sorting itself out?
There's something in there. I'm not sure what yet. I worked so hard on that novel that I'm not thinking about writing as intensely as I did 6 months ago, but I think that's a natural thing.
Yeah.
I hope it's a natural thing. It doesn't always feel like a natural thing. I feel like myself only when I'm working. And so...
Makes the moments in between kind of sketchy then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you write every day? Do you sit down at 6 a.m. and begin?
Usually.
You're disciplined in that way?
Usually. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite adjusted to the Fairbanks light yet. And so 9 a.m. feels a little like 6 a.m. It's getting better. The days are getting longer. Mm-hmm. But normally I write every day.
Mm-hmm. And that's discipline or priming the pump or both?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both.
Well, this is Where Love Leaves Us is a wonderful little book. It has stories I'd just like to recommend to the listeners as deep, enjoyable, thought-provoking, funny, sad. It's a hot little number. I hope that you go out and pick it up and read it and enjoy it. And then we can look forward to Renee's novel when it passes from agent to publisher. So keep a lookout for this name. We'll keep hearing from it. Renee, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
For talking with us today. This has been Conversations. We've been talking today with Renee Manfredi. She's an assistant professor of English and creative writing at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. That first book is called Where Love Leaves Us. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you join me again next week.
Ya conectaban 3 veces que se ha visto lo bonito. La primera fue en McAllen, en Brandville y en San Benito. En la cantina de Beca se agarraron a balazos.